Hi, my name is Jim Bindon, and I'm an old white guy who'd like to talk about race. I'd like to start with my background and how I got involved in trying to understand about race. I grew up in San Francisco from the late 1940s to the late 1960s. My first exposure to race and racism completely went over my head. When I was 5 years old, I took a trip and visited Texas and Louisiana. At the same time as the Baton Rouge bus boycott was going on to protest Jim Crow laws, I was drinking from the white drinking fountain. I remember the labels on the drinking fountains, but they made no sense to me, and it never occurred to me that I was witnessing racism in action. I was aware of segregated residential patterns in San Francisco as I grew up, but it felt to me like there was an air of tolerance in the city. In hindsight, I realized that was just my white privilege ignoring racism. When I was in grade school, the Hunters Point Public Housing Project was built almost exclusively for blacks. Earlier public housing projects had been almost exclusively reserved for whites. I didn't know about this. I thought my high school class was diverse with Italian Catholics and Eastern European Jews and WASPs like me tracing back to England through both parents, as well as African Americans, Mexican Americans, and second or third generation Asian Americans with mostly Chinese or Japanese roots. Many of the Japanese students, of course, had parents who had only been freed from the relocation centers after World War II, when they were no longer deemed a threat to national security because of their race. This also was never discussed openly. I learned about it through a family friend in Los Angeles who had a Japanese friend who had lost his property when he was sent to one of these centers. I was about 10 when I first met him, and I had no real idea of what had gone on. This came back to me in a conversation I overheard between two inductees into my high school Hall of Merit when I was inducted in 2010. Both of their families had been in the camps. It's interesting what you don't see when you don't look. I was blithely unaware of the history of racism in the San Francisco Bay Area. If I had studied it, I might have learned about it being a hotbed of eugenics early in the 20th century. The first president of Stanford University, David Starr Jordan, played a key role in expanding eugenic sterilization in the United States. In 1915, the year my dad migrated to San Francisco from Vancouver, Canada, the Panama Pacific International Exposition was held. There, the Race Betterment Foundation had a display that left no doubt about the superiority of certain kinds of Europeans over other Europeans and all others. Mexicans and Chinese had suffered extreme prejudice in California since they first arrived in the 19th century. Black migrants started coming in large numbers in the 1930s and were subjected to similar racism. But growing up, I was unaware of this history. When I was in the fifth grade, I remember my father yelling at the national news on the television when the Little Rock Nine were prevented from enrolling in high school. It was easy then to feel superior to the racist Southerners who were blocking their way. Like most white families steeped in the American racial smog, we rarely spoke about race. When we did address it, it was mostly to confirm that we weren't racists, and for the most part, I thought that was all that was needed. I graduated from high school and joined the Naval Reserves to avoid being drafted into the Army at the height of the Vietnam War. I attended UC Davis as a freshman following a pre-med curriculum. At the end of my freshman year, I was called to active duty. I was thrown together with sailors from all over the country during my training as a hospital corpsman. That was the first time that I actually saw racism in a face-to-face setting. When I finished my two-year tour, I went back to school, this time at Berkeley. I was late registering and I couldn't get the introductory course in psychology that I wanted. I could, however, get into the introduction to physical anthropology. The team teaching it included two members of the National Academy of Sciences, Sherry Washburn and F. Clark Howell. In spite of difficulties, including the firebombing of the auditorium where that class was held, and later having to dodge clouds of pepper gas from circling helicopters, I fell in love with this discipline, which, for me, merged the best aspects of science with behavioral studies. Little did I know that I was embracing the home discipline of race. I got married and didn't return to Berkeley for 2 years. One of the courses I took when I returned foreshadowed my later interest in race. That was human variation taught by Professor Vince Sarich. He taught a very different version of race than I would when I finally got around to it, one that viewed the human races as valid biological units with significant evolutionary separation. Needless to say, he did not present Richard Lewontin's then-just-published analysis of genetic variation, proving how little race actually counted for. From Berkeley, I went to study human adaptation for my grad work at Penn State. My mentor there was Paul Baker, another member of the National Academy of Sciences. His mentor at Harvard had been Ernest Houghton, who had almost single-handedly established the biological validity of race in 20th-century American academia. I had no idea of the legacy that I was pursuing. I experienced racism against myself for the first time in my first graduate field season when it was difficult to obtain housing in a Japanese residential area of Honolulu. That was a good lesson. It stayed with me. When I taught my first class at the University of Alabama in the late 1970s, I was more worried about teaching human evolution in the Bible Belt than I was about teaching race in the South. My early classes included short modules on the lack of validity of claims about race and intelligence that were rife during the 60s and 70s, but I cut that topic out entirely later in the 1980s when it seemed to me that that argument had been won and the students no longer needed that particular lesson. One of my running partners in those days was an administrator at the university. One day when I went to his office in the late 1980s, I saw a shelf of race and IQ books. I realized how ignorant this PhD was on the topic of race, and as a result, I started taking more care to cover race in every class, taking a cue for many of my presentations from Stephen Jay Gould's book, The Mismeasure of Man. That was where I stood when The Bell Curve was published in 1994. It was clear to me that this was a book that required refutation in the classroom, particularly the anthropological classroom. But I was in the middle of my stint as chairman of the anthropology department, and I didn't have the time to create a new course focusing on the issues raised by the bell curve. I started doing more reading about race, and after finishing my gig as chairman, my second semester back as a professor, I offered a tutorial on race to build my own background while I was training students on the topic. Then I proposed my course on race where I could formally try to undo 150 years of bad anthropology. About this same time, I became interested in my personal genealogy. I began finding my maternal and paternal family lines. At one point, I exchanged emails with a distant cousin on my mother's side who had done a lot of work at fleshing out that side of the family. When she shared her resources with me, one of the items that she had obtained was an 1815 will executed in Virginia from my mother's great-great-grandfather that included an appraisal of four slaves, one Negro woman named Betty, one Negro girl named Millie, one Negro boy named Tom, and one Negro girl named Mariah. The four humans were appraised at a value of $920. Reading that document changed my understanding of my privilege in a way I don't think anything else could have. I have since corresponded with another distant relative that comes from a side of my mother's family formed by one of my mother's great uncles taking one of the female slaves and starting the black wing of my maternal family. At least he had the good grace to take her as his wife. I don't want to think about the African-American relatives I have out there as a result of rape of female slaves, like in the Jefferson line, but on a much smaller scale in good old Virginia. Learning these things about my family history made the race course all the more real and important to me. The second time I taught the course, I picked up a book by Joseph Graves, The Emperor's New Clothes, Biological Theories of Race at the Millennium. That book played an important role in my development of the course. I loved his description of the history of the race concept and the accessible way that he related biological facts about human genetic variation. I already taught a lot about variation in other courses, so what I felt I needed here was to add in the historical information and make human variation understandable to folks without a significant biological background. Over the years, I have become much more familiar with the literature on slavery, Jim Crow, institutional racism, white privilege, patterns of DNA variability, and other race-related topics. The students took to the material. many of them thinking seriously about the idea of race for the first time in their lives. Because of the student response and my own love of the class, I continued to teach the course for 8 years after I retired from the University of Alabama. I still do guest lectures on race for my colleagues, and one of my anthropology colleagues, Dr. Joe Weaver, has taken over the race class now and teaches it on a yearly basis. A former anthropology doctoral student, Dr. Tina Thomas, sat in on the race class, and now she teaches her own variation of it at Juniata. Through the race class, I also became acquainted with a history professor, Dr. Eric Peterson, who teaches about the history of the race concept and who is letting me collaborate with him on a book project about the history of race and science. Because of all my work over the last 20 years, and also because of my lived experience, I think I have things to say about race that may be helpful in putting it into perspective for others. At the very least, if you listen along, you'll learn some fascinating trivia for cocktail party talk. Thank you for bearing with me.